This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive. FM.
Those guys have got some lungs, eh? Okay, that was appropriate to what's in the headlines right now. That was the Rostavi Choir singing heroic songs and hymns from Georgia. Now, lest I be accused of prejudice in this conflict, I was actually searching for some music from Abkhazia or from Ossetia and failed to find any, but I actually do have this choral music, this extremely powerful choral music from Georgia. So I'm playing it. If anybody can help us out with traditional music from Abkhazia and Ossetia, I'd love to play some. But last week, you know, we were talking about, well, first let me say that last week on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, which is what you're listening to, the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. My name is Bill Weinberg. This music is from Shaniki Records, the Rostavi Choir, part of the whole, obviously, you know, cultural resurgence of traditional Georgian culture, which has been underway in the past, 15 years now? More than 15 years that they've been free from the Soviet Union since 1991. My goodness, that's 17 years, isn't it? My goodness, how time flies. And last week we were talking in the context of China and particularly Xinjiang and the Uyghurs about the great game, which persists, unfortunately, to this day, and how the national aspirations of small ethnicities are manipulated by world powers in the sort of the big chess game for control of Eurasia and, in contemporary times, its precious hydrocarbon resources. And as we noted last week, the Uyghurs and Tibetans in the People's Republic of China, in their quest for autonomy, have been manipulated into the camp of the United States to a certain degree. And unfortunately, over the course of the past week, we have had opportunity to witness very, very dramatically that the Ossetians and Abkhazians of Georgia have been similarly manipulated into the camp of Russia for its own imperial aspirations in the Caucasus. So, the interesting thing in terms of the music is that while I was digging through my collection, last week I was digging through my collection trying to find some music from the Uyghurs and failed. So instead, I brought music from the Mongols and the Buryat people, who are ethnically related to the Uyghurs, although actually their music is very different. I would imagine that the music of the Uyghurs played 1,000 years ago was pretty similar to that of the Mongols. But since then, the Uyghurs have fallen within the, over the course of, say, the past 500 years, fallen within the greater Persian cultural sphere. And there's a lot, much more of a Persian feel to their music today. So I continued to dig. This week I was digging. I found this music from Georgia, but sort of to be even-handed, I also wanted to play some music from Ossetia or Abkhazia. So I was digging, and lo and behold, like, guess what? I found some Uyghur music. So failed to find Abkhazian music, but found some Uyghur music, which I failed to find last week. So maybe next week we'll return to the whole Uyghur situation, which also happens to be escalating. There was another attack in Xinjiang today. But right now, I think we're going to focus on the really horrific situation in Georgia, which finally in the last 12 hours or so, there's some signs that maybe, with luck, it's starting to de-escalate a little. But it's certainly been a horrific few days, very, very frightening few days. So I failed to find it in music from Abkhazia, but I did find a book in my collection, entitled Abkhazians, The Long Living People of the Caucasus, by Sula Bennett, from Case Studies in Cultural Anthropology, published in, back when it was all still the Soviet Union, back in, this is Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston Incorporated, way back in, 1974. Okay, not that long ago. All right. So those people you always hear about up in the Caucasus who live on yogurt and survive well into their triple digits. They live to be like 120 and so on. Well, that's the Abkhaz. You also hear about the Hunza, who similarly live on yogurt and survive up into their triple digits. But there in the Himalayas, in what's now Pakistan, the Abkhaz, unfortunately, been in the news for bad reasons. Now, I really wish this week they've been in the news for some very unfortunate reasons, but they're the people in the Caucasus who similarly live on yogurt and survive to be, 120 years old. Let's see, there's a picture in this book. Damn, I wish I could find some of their music. There's a picture in this book of Abkhaz musicians playing some kind of a very strange sort of spiked fiddle and what looks to be like a santoor, that is to say the Persian hammer dulcimer, as well as some wind instruments. And they've all got these big, bushy handlebar mustaches. And they've all got, of course, fur caps on. And it looks like it's probably pretty cold, but they look extremely vigorous. And two of them are up there dancing, doing some kind of traditional folk dance routine with their legs in the air. And the caption reads, singers, dancers, and musicians all over 90 years of age. Oh, boy. Looks like they've got more vim and vigor in them at 90 than I do at 46. Maybe I should be living in Abkhazia. Singers, dancers, and musicians all over 90 years of age in Sukhumi, Abkhazia, with their conductor. And the conductor is sort of standing there conducting, clapping his hands while these guys are playing their spiked fiddles and their santors and dancing with their legs up in the air, all of them in their 90s. Sukhumia is, of course, today the capital of what they call the de facto government of Abkhazia, which is not recognized by anybody but Russia. And in fact, it's not even officially recognized by Russia, although it's, I would say, de facto recognized by Russia. And certainly backed militarily by Russia. And, both Abkhazia and Ossetia and Georgia generally have been the scenes of really, really horrific bloodshed just over the past 3 or 4 days. It'll be a while, I think, before the smoke clears and we really get a very clear picture of what happened. And hopefully it's going to de-escalate from this point, so the human rights groups and so on will be able to go in and collect accounts and try to figure out, in fact, what did happen. But right for up until now, their work has been impeded, of course, as well as, as that of humanitarian workers, because they haven't had access to the region because of the horrific violence. So, what all this is about, I think we can safely say, is access to oil and the pipeline, the so-called Baku-Ceyhan pipeline, which runs from Azerbaijan to the Turkish Mediterranean port of Ceyhan, recently completed by a consortium led by British Petroleum to deliver the hydrocarbon resources of the Caspian Basin to Western markets, beating a Russian pipeline proposal, which would have gone through Russian territory, to the punch. And in fact, the previous pipeline, which ran from the Caspian through Russia up to the Baltic Sea, built by the Soviets, was destroyed during the Chechnya War 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago at this point, in 1995 it would have been. So Russia sort of correctly perceives that resources which were under Moscow's control just 20 years ago have now been appropriated by the West. And, of course, Georgia was moving towards joining NATO, which clearly is what prompted Russia to make this move. And how it all began is still rather unclear, actually. And, of course, it began a little bit more than a week ago, about 5 days ago, when villages which were either in the hands of the Russian-backed separatists or in the hands of the official Georgian government in the area of South Ossetia started shelling each other, or military forces in those villages started shelling each other, and it just escalated from there. And it still is not clear who started shelling who first, and really, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I would argue that there aren't any angels here. This is all once again great powers trying to appropriate the oil resources of the Caspian Basin to build their own power and their own imperial aspirations towards global dominance, and using the small peoples of the region as pawns and cannon fodder, much as we were discussing last week vis-a-vis the Uyghurs and the Tibetans. So let's see, maybe we'll delve into this a little bit deeper, and who knows, maybe we'll take some phone calls. I particularly appeal, if there's anybody out there who, if there's anybody out there who speaks Georgian and can tell us what the Rostavi choir is singing about, please give us a call when we take phone calls in about 45 minutes. At 212-209-2900, because the liner notes provide a certain small degree of translation, but just a smattering of translation here and there, not a comprehensible translation. So all that was translated to that first cut that we heard, which is called Odoya, is Odoya, take the hoe, Jigoya. Come on, boys, come on. So not a lot of context here, let's hear a little bit more of it. Sorry, that's the first thing. If anybody out there can help us translate, if anybody out there speaks Georgian and can help us translate what the Rostavi choir is singing about, please give us a call when we take calls in around 45 minutes at 212-209-2900. Or if there's anybody out there who actually has access to any music of the Abkhazians or the Ossetians, we'd love to play it, once again, we think that we're not like, taking sides one side or the other. We just view it as tragic that the ethnicities of this region have been pitted against each other in these imperial power plays and strategies. And, okay, we'll talk a little bit more about that, and do a little bit of reading from the book The Abkhazians, Long Living People of the Caucasus by Sula Bennett. We'll just read the section on Abkhazian history and get a little bit of background as to what this is all about. And but first, you know what we're going to do? We're going to play a little bit more of the Rostavi Choir, Heroic Songs and Hymns from Georgia, and then we'll just do a brief announcement, a reading, a little discussion, play a little bit more music, and we'll take your calls in about a half an hour. If anybody has anything to say about a really grave situation, which has got pretty terrifying implications for world peace, this could well be a flashpoint for global conflagration if it doesn't chill out soon. Okay, so let's hear a little bit more of the Rostavi Choir. Here, let's hear cut 7, because it appears to be rather historically didactic. Hey, Some more from the Rastavi Choir, Heroic Songs and Hymns from Georgia. That was entitled Ali Pasha, which I assume is a reference to Mehmet Ali Pasha, who was the an Ottoman general who campaigned against the Russians in the Caucasus in the 19th century. And a partial translation here. The Turk and the Russian are fighting. Both of them are devils. Ali Pasha betrayed us and led us to Kvirikheti. But nothing good happened to him either. He was tied up with ropes and put on a ship. Well, I confess that I don't know a great deal of the historical background. Once again, if anybody can help us out, if there's any scholars of the history of the Caucasus out there who can help us out with some historical background, please give us a call when we take calls at around 1 o'clock at 212-209-2900. But certainly for centuries, the Ottoman Empire and the Russian Empire contested over control of the Caucasus, and their armies went back and forth through Georgia. And at times Georgia was under the control of one, and at times it was under the control of the other. And they weren't very happy about being under the control of either. So I don't know, maybe it was Georgian partisans who tied up Ali Pasha and put him on a ship, dispatched him back to Constantinople, I assume. Well, I'm going to have to look into this history. Maybe we can glean a little bit something of it from the book Abkhazians, The Long Living People of the Caucasus. Here, why don't we read the chapter on the history of Abkhazia. But before we do, tell you what. I have one announcement. I announced it last week, but I'm going to announce it again because it actually it relates to not in geographical terms, but in thematic terms. It relates to what we're discussing tonight, which is the right of small ethnicities to self-determination in spite of the imperial intrigues which play out over their lands. And once again, August 18th, which is going to be next Monday, a week from yesterday, at Blue Stockings Books on the Lower East Side, the East Timor Action Network, ETAN, is going to be hosting a forum entitled Justice for East Timor, with a question mark, Impunity for Crimes Against Humanity, and the Commission on Truth and Friendship, which is going to be a very critical look, I assume, at the joint East Timorese-Indonesian Commission on Truth and Friendship, which has just released its report. And it's going to be featuring John Miller of the East Timor Action Network and Matt Easton of Human Rights First and historian Eben Trino Molenkamp. And they are going to be once again, taking a critical look at the Commission on Truth and Friendship, which acknowledges Indonesian responsibility for severe human rights violations in East Timor in 1999, but also encourages impunity for those responsible for crimes against humanity. So if you want to get up to speed on this stuff, once again, that's going to be 7 p.m. next Monday, August 18th, at Blue Stockings Books on the Lower East Side. And do they give the address for Blue Stockings Books? They certainly should. There they go, 172 Allen Street, which is either south of Houston or north of Delancey, depending on how you look at it, depending on which direction you're walking from. 172 Houston Street on the Lower East Side, Blue Stockings Books, next Monday, August 18th, 7 p.m. I might try to make that one. If so, see you there. All right, so let's see. I'll give a station break now. It's 12:26 in the morning. Here on listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI, 99.5 FM, here in New York City. My name is Bill Weinberg. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. And here, let's see what we can glean from the chapter entitled History of Abkhazia, from the book Abkhazians, the Long-Living People of the Caucasus. No one knows the origins of the Abkhazians. 19th century writers thought them unrelated to any other tribe in the Caucasus. Their own legends indicate that they have always lived on the same territory and that they descended either from a race of giants or a race of dwarfs, or both. All the evidence points to their continuous occupation of the land over the last three millennia. Some stories refer to early migrations from Asia Minor. Archaeological, historical, and linguistic studies confirm the antiquity and striking continuity of their culture, despite centuries of raids and occupations by neighboring people. Invaders took slaves and cattle, but had no desire to settle on such poor land. The Caucasian region has sometimes been considered a part of Asia and sometimes part of Europe. For centuries, the inhabitants of this area have been mentioned in the chronicles of travelers amazed at their longevity and good health, as well as the multiplicity of tongues they speak. Ancient Arab writers called the Caucasus Jubel al-Sunni, or Mountain of Languages, and they were right. Over 200 different ethnic groups live there, each with a distinct language. Before the development of the Abkhazian alphabet, the only available history is a sketchy reconstruction based on ancient chronicles and records kept by outsiders. Toward the end of the first millennium BC, the area was populated by many small tribes, which underwent numerous changes of alliance, consolidation, and separation. These shifts eventually culminated in the formation of two confederations, the Abkhazians in the north, the Abazines in the north, and the Apsils in the south. Today the people call themselves Apuza, preserving the name Apsil. Apuza simply means the people or the souls. During the 6th to 5th century BC, two Greek colonies were established on the shores of the Black Sea for the purposes of trade and acquiring slaves. Subsequent Greek chronicles refer to the Abazgi. Pliny refers to Abkhazia as Apsies. The influence of this slave-holding culture quickened the development of commerce and may have stimulated the growth of social classes. Local tribes began to trade their produce, skins, wool, cattle, fish, bread, timber, wax, and honey, for weapons, fabrics, and other manufactured goods. Between the 4th and 6th centuries AD, Abkhazia became a kingdom subject to West Georgia, itself a vassal of the Byzantine Empire. In 523 AD, during the reign of Justinian, Christianity was declared the state religion and was forcibly imposed on the people. Between the 3rd and 6th centuries, the southern Caucasian feudal system developed into a form which persisted until the abolition of serfdom in 1861 in Russia and 1870 in Abkhazia. The feudal hierarchy was as follows. The Akh was the prince of all Abkhazia. The Atavad were the prince vassals. The Amstra, the noblemen. The Ashknakma were an intermediary group between the nobles and the peasants, or the squires. The Akipisi were the peasants with some obligations. The Akanu were the freehold peasants. The Akoyu were the dependent peasants, and the Ate were the slaves. This system was considerably modified by the traditional patriarchal clan structure. In the absence of a strong centralized authority, with some noblemen not acknowledging the sovereignty of the ruling prince, and some lesser nobles not acknowledging the dominion of greater nobles, lineage tended to carry greater power. Most political, economic, and social functions were regulated by lineage. The social order was based on two principles. The right of each person to bear and use weapons, and two, family affiliations. Both sexes were trained in horseback riding and weaponry, and the right to use weapons distinguished a free person from a slave. During the 6th to 8th centuries, the Abkhazian people fought for independence against Byzantine, Persian, and Arab invasions. These struggles helped to consolidate Abkhazia into a nation. Toward the end of the 8th century, Abkhazia and western Georgia were unified under an Abkhazian king. The next 200 years marked the highest development of local culture. However, feudal struggles in Georgia resulted in the incorporation of Abkhazia into a larger Georgian nation by the end of the 10th century. Since the Abkhazians had no alphabet, some members of the nobility used the Georgian and Greek languages. Georgian became so popular that it eventually superseded Greek, and a few families even took Georgian names. For example, the lineage Shervashidze was originally called Chachpa. Nonetheless, Abkhazian was cherished by the common people and remained in use along the Black Sea. The introduction of the alphabet has now precluded its disappearance. The end of the 15th century brought the trying period of Turkish rule and the forcible introduction of the Sunni sect of Islam. The Turks who attempted to assimilate Abkhazians into their culture, the Turks also attempted to assimilate Abkhazians into their culture, and many individuals and whole families were enslaved and sold abroad. From 1578, Abkhazia was under the protection of Turkey, but Turkey was not strong enough to prevent Abkhazia from having political alliances with Georgian principalities. During this period, Abkhazia was divided by the Georgians according to these established alliances. By the 17th century, Abkhazia finally reconsolidated itself into a semi-independent state, but the people still suffered from the aggressive assimilation policies and increasing slave trading of the Turks. All these events impoverished the Abkhazian culture. Again and again, the Abkhazians joined forces with the Georgians to fight the Turks, and finally, in 1771, the Turks were driven out. In the beginning of the 19th century, Abkhazia, together with Georgia and other Caucasian nations, sought the protection of the Russians, and in 1810, Abkhazia officially became a part of the Russian Empire as a semi-independent state. In 1864, when the Tsarist regime secured the Caucasus, Abkhazia became a province of Russia. But the colonial policies of Tsarist Russia did not suit the Abkhazians, and there were many peasant revolts in 1821, 1824, and 1857. The largest revolt took place in 1866 in Likhny, when a number of high Russian officials were killed by the Abkhazians. After putting down the revolt, the Russians confiscated all the weapons of the population, a measure unheard of in the Caucasus, and the Abkhazians were declared, quote, unfaithful subjects, unquote. Rather an irony, given the particular juxtaposition at the moment. Political and religious harassment from the Russians and misleading promises from Turkey, who wished to populate her barren lands with immigrants, led to mass emigration of Abkhazians to Turkey. Since large numbers of Abkhazians had already adopted Islam, they felt they had a better chance in an Islamic country than a Christian one. Extensive migrations took place in 1858 to 1864, 1870, and 1877. Yet some did stay behind. In place of those who left came new settlers loyal to the Russians, and Abkhazian land was turned over to them. Those Abkhazian Muslims who remained in their homeland, being unwilling to accept Christianity, were accused of disloyalty to Russia and to the Tsar. At the beginning of the 20th century, Abkhazia was a typical colonial province of Tsarist Russia. She was poor, underdeveloped, and over 92% illiterate in any language. In 1903, the people of Dorypsh wrote a petition asking the governor to make the two-class school in Gudwat into a high school and to allocate funds for this. Of 150 people who were present at the meeting, only one could sign the document, and he did so with great difficulty. Economically, Abkhazians in pre-revolutionary times had lived at subsistence level with no industry and no working class. Some tobacco fields were planted around the turn of the 20th century, but tobacco was not processed there. The few salaried workers earned very little. By this time, a kulak class was beginning to emerge from the originally egalitarian village, consisting of those peasants who held better and more land than their neighbors. Of course, the best land was in the hands of the local nobility. In 1909, the Tsarist governor of the Caucasus wrote that most peasants had to pay rent and pay in crops, had to rent land and pay in crops. Excuse me. They had been reduced to sharecroppers. Feudalism in Abkhazia, even during its highest development, was weak because of the mobility and independence of the Abkhazians. Also, the peasants and princes were tied to each other by a network of ritual kinships which cut across class lines. They learned the same customs, had the same manners, and spoke with the same accent. If a prince were accused of a crime, he had to swear his innocence before the village assembly, just like any other man. By the time the revolution came, the nobility was so impoverished that they were on the same economic level as the peasantry and could not be considered enemies of the people to be stripped of their prestige and influence. Now, as in the past, the educated Abkhazian maintains close ties with his less educated relatives. Nevertheless, some class conflict existed, which was swept away by the Russian Revolution. In 1917, in the village of Likhny, 3,000 people, princes, minor nobility, and peasants, attended a meeting. The Akh, or prince of all Abkhazia, used to live in this village, and a sacred tree, several hundred years old, grew in the square. At this meeting, the Bolshevik position predominated. Nestor Lakhba, a revolutionary leader, called for an end of the privileges of the nobility. When the nobles were ready to leave, the peasants were supposed to help them mount their horses, but Lakhba said not to do it. The nobles had to mount unassisted while the peasants stood by, a difficult thing, not because they were afraid, but because Abkhazians have a strong sense of obligation and propriety. In 1921, Abkhazia became a Soviet republic. In 1930, it became an autonomous part of Georgia and of the USSR. And it doesn't say so, but I would imagine that this was a part of a tilt to Georgia on the part of Stalin, who was from Georgia himself, and probably wanted to reward his own kinspeople with a little piece of real estate. The new regime brought economic stability and prosperity to the Caucasus, an end to the perennial raids for cattle and slaves, and a tremendous reduction in family feuding. Okay, so there we have it, a little bit on the history of the Abkhazians, the long-living people of the Caucasus, from the book of that title by Sula Bennett, from the Case Studies in Cultural Anthropology series, published in 1974. And, okay, so the Abkhazians are one of these indigenous peoples of the Caucasus who maybe, you know, these various individual, you know, small ethnicities of the Caucasus whose languages are not related to any outside languages, maybe they're related to each other. I think possibly the Abkhaz language might be distantly related to Georgian. Not quite sure, but certainly it's not related to any language in the outside world. They are truly an indigenous people. They've been there for 3,000 years. The Ossetians, I understand, are related to the Persians, despite the fact that they are separated from Persia by the Caucasus Mountains. And their territory, this is really the most recent crisis, was sparked in Ossetia. Their territory was divided, I guess, in a compromise between Russian and Georgian territorial aspirations. Their territory was divided in two by the Soviets, with North Ossetia being in the Russian SSR, Soviet Socialist Republic, and South Ossetia being in the Georgian SSR. So when Georgia achieved independence with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, the South Ossetians wanted to remain united with the North Ossetians and declared their own independence from Georgia. And Russia backed them up, hoping to eventually unite the two Ossetias and under Russian rule, and thereby seize a little piece of Georgia and begin to reconstruct their empire. The Abkhazians revolted from Georgian rule in 1993, if memory serves. And at the time, there were very, very horrific allegations of the ethnic Georgians being ethnically cleansed from Abkhazia. And in fact, Abkhazia is divided. There's the Kodori Gorge, which is this one valley which is actually under the control of the Georgian government. And the rest of it is under the control of the Abkhazian de facto separatist government, which is backed by Russia. There was a ceasefire which was worked out, which gave Russia the right to maintain peacekeepers in Abkhazia. But and then for the next 10 years after that, things were more or less peaceful. But then just in the past couple of years, it started to heat up again, and there's been more and more border skirmishes and guerrilla attacks and so on. And you've got an ethnic Georgian guerrilla group in Abkhazia, which would like to take the territory back for Georgia, calling itself the White Legion, which is a very ominous name for people who know their Russian history. It's got some rather odious implications. Similarly, there have been all these allegations of... a few months back, there was a Georgian drone aircraft supplied by Israel, which was shot down apparently by a Russian warplane, although the Russians denied it. But the Georgians insist that's what happened. And so, I mean, little incidents like this have been going on. And then there were a bunch of terrorist attacks a few weeks back in Abkhazia, which was blamed on these Georgian guerrillas. So it's been escalating for the past 3 years. After the ceasefire, after more or less 10 years of peace, it's been escalating again in the last 3 years, and it just exploded over the weekend, of course, as we're aware. Okay, now what happened over the course of the past 3 years to suddenly make this heat up again? Well, you know, I would argue that the most significant thing which happened is that the Baku-Ceyhan pipeline went online. You know, there was this sort of race which was going on throughout the 90s as to whether the oil resources of the Caspian Basin were going to be delivered to Western markets, you know, as Chevron and British Petroleum and so on started making deals with Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan and all these post-Soviet republics, which have just been transformed to free market economies and so on. There was a race throughout the 90s as to whether the pipeline was going to go through, was going to be controlled by the West and was going to go through the Caucasus in Turkey, or whether it was going to go through Russia. And while the Russian pipeline, I believe, is... they're still going ahead with the Russian pipeline. The pipeline, which is essentially controlled by the West, built by a consortium led by British Petroleum and passing through the nations of Azerbaijan, Georgia, and Turkey, all of them in the Western camp. That really is what that's attracted the big investment, and that's what the big money is betting on. It terminates at the Turkish port of Ceyhan, which is also where the Mosul-Ceyhan pipeline terminates, which is now delivering the oil resources of Iraq to international markets. And, okay, that finally went on in, went online, that pipeline went online, the Baku-Ceyhan pipeline went online in 2003, if memory serves. And in this same period, there was a big push on the part of Georgia to join NATO. And obviously, there's this very deep fear in Georgia of resurgent Russian imperial aspirations, and they're looking to the rival superpower to protect them. So, you know, it's kind of like just like in Cold War times, the same basic struggle is continuing, only now the Russian influence sphere has been very, very significantly reduced, quite obviously. And all of the Russian fears, traditional Russian fears about encirclement, have been vindicated. And while all of this was happening, or a significant step in this direction was the so-called Rose Revolution of November 2003, when Edward Shevardnadze, the Georgian president, Edward Shevardnadze, the Georgian president and significantly the former Soviet foreign minister, and sort of in the Russian camp, or at least kind of trying to play equidistant between the two superpowers, was overthrown. There were contested elections and there were big protests, and he was overthrown. In a civil movement which was wide accusations that it was backed by the U.S., that USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy and George Soros and so on were pouring money into the revolution in Georgia. And probably it's true, but probably also people had some legitimate reasons to be angry, and maybe the elections weren't all that clean. But this was the first of the so-called color revolutions, which was followed by the Orange Revolution in Ukraine and then the Tulip Revolution in Kyrgyzstan just about a year and a half later. And then there was an attempted the last of the revolutionary movements in this wave. There was sort of an attempted revolution on the same model in Uzbekistan. In the summer of 2005, which was aborted, which was put down with quite considerable bloodshed. What this was, in the whole period between 2003 and 2005, just before things started to really, really go bad in Iraq, this was when the neocons were really on a roll. And this was, a part of their whole plan to remake not just the Middle East, but really, you know, all of Eurasia. And one could argue all of the world. And it was perceived that all of these countries were too close to the Russian orbit, and that they even if they'd been playing ball with the U.S., they weren't reliable enough clients. And they were also playing ball with Russia and with China. And what was needed were, you know, compliant regimes which would not play ball with Russia or China, but would just play ball with the U.S. So, Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan both opened their territory to U.S. military forces after 9/11 to help, coordinate the campaign in Afghanistan. And then they started making some noises about, well, you know, maybe you guys have been here long enough. You know, maybe it's time to think about leaving. And then, lo and behold, these revolutionary movements sprung up. And I don't doubt that these revolutionary movements were being avidly egged on by Washington. But that isn't to say that people didn't have legitimate reasons to be angry. And, you know, particularly in the case of Uzbekistan, where this Islam Karimov was and continues to be in power. Okay, now, he used to be, as FDR said about the Nicaraguan dictator Anastasio Somoza, our son of a bitch. And, you know, he was playing ball with Washington and allowing his country to serve as a staging ground for the campaign in Afghanistan. And playing ball with U.S. Imperial designs in the region and receiving U.S. aid and receiving U.S. military advisors and the whole package. And meanwhile, I mean, his human rights record was absolutely atrocious. I mean, the most ghastly, you know, grisly tortures you can imagine. I mean, the kind of stuff that you read about in, tales from the Middle Ages of people being, you know, boiled alive in vats of acid and stuff like that. Really, really, really grisly stuff. So, you know, of course, he was our son of a bitch back when he was our son of a bitch, and now he's Moscow's son of a bitch, right? So, of course, people had reason to be angry. So there was plenty of, you know, ripe fodder for Washington to fan the flames of protest. And in fact, that was the one so-called color revolution, which did not succeed. It didn't even have time to be assigned a color before it was put down with really horrific massacres, perhaps 500 or more killed by government troops in the city of Andijan in May of 2005. But really, bringing it back to Georgia, it all began in Georgia. And Georgia was sort of the showcase, and Georgia was the one country in this region which was actually moving towards joining NATO and actually establishing very close ties to the U.S. military. When the U.S. military continues to have troops in Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia, and then there were just last year in last November, there were a big wave of protests against the new president, Saakashvili. Just like Saakashvili had led the protest against Shevardnadze back in the Rose Revolution in November of 2003, then exactly how many years later? 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007. Exactly 4 years later, there was a big wave of protests against him, against Saakashvili. After he started acting like an authoritarian thug and having opposition leaders summarily arrested on spurious charges of Russian espionage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there was a big wave of protest against him. And lo and behold, what do you think he does? He accuses, you know, the protesters of all being Russian agents and so on, just like Shevardnadze had accused the protesters of all being American agents. So, rather ironic, right? It seems like, you know, people, those in power, never seem to have any reason to believe that anybody would have any legitimate reason to be unhappy with them, right? It's always got to be external subversion. And that doesn't, you know, say that, you know, the external subversion doesn't exist, just like probably the State Department did have a hand in the Rose Revolution. Probably Russia also had a hand in the protests in Georgia last year. But that doesn't mean that people didn't also have legitimate reason to be angry, right? I mean, you've got to have some raw material of unrest to exploit, okay? No matter how much money you've got at your disposal, no matter how much political power you've got at your disposal. So this whole sort of conspiratorial way of looking at these things is of limited utility, shall we say. Okay, so the pipeline goes online in the Baku-Ceyhan pipeline under the control of a Western consortium led by British Petroleum, and I think Chevron has also got a hand in it, went online in 2003, I believe, same year as the Rose Revolution, bypasses not only Russia, but any countries which are in the Russian sphere, but goes through Azerbaijan, which is now tilting to the west, Georgia, which is very, very strongly tilting to the west and is aspiring to join NATO, and Turkey, which is, of course, a NATO member. All of a sudden, lo and behold, after 10 years of peace, relative peace, there's all of these border skirmishes which start breaking out, first, most significantly, in Abkhazia. and escalating and escalating until finally there were, you know, terrorist attacks earlier this year, and then finally the crisis just last week in South Ossetia, where once again villages which were either in Russian hands or in Georgian hands started shelling each other, and it's unclear who fired the first shot, and it doesn't really matter. So in response to this, you know. Well, first, Georgia took it as an opportunity to seize back South Ossetia, and they held it for about a day. And according to the Russians now, they committed genocide, quote-unquote, for that day that they were in power. Maybe it was a little bit more than a day. Certainly couldn't have been much more than 48 hours at the most. Russia is alleging that something like 12,000 people were killed, and they're calling for an international tribunal, et cetera, et cetera. Shortly thereafter, the Russians launched a counteroffensive and pushed back the Georgians, and not only pushed them out of South Ossetia, but pushed them out of all the way into Georgia, and in fact occupied just about all of northern Georgia. And it appeared just this morning, it appeared that they were about to take the capital, take Tbilisi. And they bombed. According to the Georgian government, they attempted to bomb the pipeline. They attempted to bomb the Baku-Ceyhan pipeline. And in fact, now, consortium led by British Petroleum has shut down the pipeline. They deny that it was bombed, but they shut it down because they fear that it's about to be, damaged one way or another in the conflict. And, another pipeline which goes through Georgia, which goes to the, to the Black Sea port of, let me consult my, let's see, I should remember, but let's see, the Black Sea port of Supsa. Yes, there's a second pipeline which goes from Azerbaijan to the Black Sea port of Supsa, a smaller pipeline also built within the past 5 years, which has been shut down because the Russians bombed the port. So, apparently, you know, I mean, not only industrial infrastructure, but also civilian areas have been bombed. So there are accounts of atrocities on both sides. And now it appears, just in the last few hours, that President Sarkozy of France has arranged a ceasefire where everything is going to go back to the status quo ante. And Russia is going to withdraw to its to the positions which it held a week ago, and so is Georgia. And once again, I would imagine that Abkhazia and South Ossetia, if the peace plan goes ahead, are still going to remain in this limbo where they're under the de facto control of separatists who are backed by Russia, but under the de jure control of Georgia, and under, you know, under the internationally recognized but nonetheless fictional control of Georgia. And but the thing is that Saakashvili, the president of Georgia, is saying that the fighting in fact hasn't stopped in spite of this apparent peace deal which has been worked out. He says that the Russians are continuing to bomb his territory. And that there are, over the course of the past day, there have been 50 Russian bombers in the air over Georgia. So, now it's, I'll give the station break now at 2 minutes of 1 o'clock in the morning here on listener supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM. And this is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. My name is Bill Weinberg. We're going to play a little bit more from the Rostavi Choir. Heroic songs and hymns from Georgia. And, you know, I just like to sum up by saying that this is a war for oil. This is another grisly chapter in the great game. That the Georgians, the Abkhaz, and the Ossetians alike are being treated as pawns on the chessboard by the great powers, primarily by Russia and the United States. And that ultimately none of what has happened over the past 5 days is in the interest of any of the people of this region, is in the interest of any of their self-determination or long-term, well-being, and that none of the political leaders have acted like angels, to say the least. And I would like to know, unfortunately, I've been digging and digging and digging on the web, and I've been unable to find anything. Where are the anti-militarists, the pacifists, the anarchists, etc., in Russia and in Georgia alike, who are going to protest the behavior of their own governments without, merely playing into the propaganda of the other side, quote unquote, and take a sort of a neither nor position. And ultimately, if Georgia is not going to be, if Georgia is going to turn to NATO and British Petroleum to protect it from being recolonized by Russia, it's merely trading one colonial master for another. And similarly, if the Abkhazians and the Ossetians are going to turn to Russia to protect them from being colonized by Georgia, they've simply traded one imperial master for another. And what's the alternative to this? Because it's easy for me to propound this analysis from the safety of New York City. But if there are Russian troops or Georgian troops or the Abkhaz separatists or the White Legion or any of the other forces in this game, where, coming to attack my village, I would be in a position of having to take my allies where I could find them. I acknowledge this. I acknowledge this. So I'm not condescending to the Georgians or to the Abkhazians or to the Ossetians. I'm merely looking for a way forward, which serves the interest of true local rule and self-determination, and not the petro-imperialists, be they of Washington, Moscow, London, or anywhere else. Nobody's calling in, so I guess we're just going to play more Georgian music for the remaining half an hour, unless somebody calls in and has something to say. At 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. I particularly appeal to anybody who's from the region. Anybody who can help us translate what the Rostavi choir is singing about from the Georgian. Anybody who can give us a clue as to how to get some traditional music from Abkhazia or Ossetia. And particularly anybody who's got contacts in the region who are once again, anti-militarist, pacifists, anarchists, military resistors, anybody who's issued some kind of statement, anything, which is taking a consistent anti-militarist, anti-imperialist position on this conflict. Because I would love to give them a voice here in New York through the media available to me, including WBAI, to which you are tuned at this moment. We're going to take your phone calls in just a few minutes. Let's hear a little bit more Georgian music, and then we'll take your phone calls at 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. Oh. Wow, what lungs! Unbelievable. Good stuff. The Rastavi Choir, heroic hymns and songs from Georgia, from Shanaki Records. Okay, the number, we're opening up the phone line now. The number is 212-209-2900, and I'm gonna be cool and mellow and tranquilo tonight, I promise. Nobody is going to get me agitated. So don't be shy about calling, please. 212-209-2900. WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello?
Hello.
Hello.
Hello there.
You're on the air.
Hey, fantastic show. Thank you so much for great analysis and, really clear-minded thinking. It's really appreciated.
Well, thank you for your comments. I do my best.
Man, you're really doing a great job on that. I mean, it's really refreshing to be able to, to think rationally about some of these situations when listening to the media. It's not easy. And, it's our, I'd like to comment on, or maybe open a little bit of discussion about the question that you posed in regard to where are the people of conscience, the anarchists, et cetera, in, the different cities. Different places in the country. First of all, I'd like to draw your attention to that incredible music that you're listening to.
Yeah.
And for anybody who's familiar with the liturgical music of the Russian Orthodox Church, you might find incredible similarities between that piece that we just listened to.
Oh, well, definitely, of course.
So yeah. I think that that's a bit of a sign of the difference that we might feel here at the safety of New York City, and as in regard in relative to the position of the people in, let's say, up in Russia or in that region in general. There are spheres of influence, and this was clearly, this is like BP putting an oil pipeline there, and maybe NATO attempting to put, missiles like they did in the Czech Republic, might be akin to,
Well, they're attempting to put they're not attempting to put missiles in the Czech Republic. They're attempting to put a radar system. For a missile system in the Czech Republic.
Yeah. Well, might be akin to somebody trying to put them in New Jersey. And then maybe we'd be able to feel the types of, the magnitude and intensity of the issue that maybe the people right on the other side of the border of Georgia, which is Russian territory, how the people might feel in Russia and why they might be not so quick to run out and to oppose their government.
Okay, well, on the other hand, just playing devil's advocate here, the reason that the Georgians are welcoming NATO is because they've historically been under the Russian heel and feel that they need protection from resurgent Russian imperial ambitions. And this whole episode that we've witnessed over the past 5 days would only seem to confirm their worst fears. So I think we can also understand why the Georgians are not opposing their government.
Absolutely. But as Americans, I think, raising the question where we as Americans, probably the only actions that we could do as citizens of this country here is to take whatever actions are possible in order to limit Western expansion into that region so that they have the opportunity perhaps to resolve those issues themselves. That's like that one pipeline that's going to build from Baku, that they've built from Baku, is like a straw into the Caspian Basin. And they're just sucking a disproportionate amount of wealth because they're just fueled with money and abilities from Western companies to be able to extract the resources that are sovereign to those localities.
Right, but they aren't. If you say sovereign to those localities, that would also preclude Moscow's control as well.
Absolutely, but it's a tough world. I think that Yeah, man. You know, I think you know. I think you're hit. You know, you're hitting all of the all of the buttons, and the tough people that gotta be caught up in a mix of this this global phenomenon. I want to ask the question: where is the anarchist in the United States in some type of meaningful effort to try to get the United States to pull out of Afghanistan, to get the United States to pull out of Iraq? That's more to the, that's more really hitting it on what we can do here in this country.
Well, we've certainly given plenty of attention to the situation in Iraq and what the political dilemmas are in terms of trying to build an effective anti-war movement in this country, but that's not what we're talking about tonight. We've certainly spoken about it plenty. Anyway, thank you for your call.
Sure, man.
I'm going to squeeze in a couple more.
I know. Bye-bye.
212-209-2900. 212-209-2900. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yes, hello?
Hello.
Yes, I'm Carpatho-Ruthenian by descent, by parentage. So I have some degree of first-hand knowledge of the vicious anti-communists in Eastern Europe who were also vicious anti-Semites who did more killing of Jews than Hitler. Now, NATO out of the former Soviet Union is the correct orientation, victory to the Red Army being rebuilt under Putin, along with the Chinese fighting the Uyghurs, who are now killing Chinese border guards daily, but you don't care about that, really.
Well, I would just... I wouldn't say I don't care about it. I would say that I question why the Uyghurs are so angry at the Chinese. What's my question?
My parentage. George Soros. See, all these restive peoples resenting the Russians got down with the fascist Nazis during World War II, and they helped.
Right, as did Stalin, as I recall, for a couple of years between 1939 and 1941. Right.
I understand. Hail Red Army fighting in Georgia.
Okay. 212-209-2900 is the number. If anybody has anything more elucidating to say, 212-209-2900, and nobody does, so. Okay, WBAI, you're on the air. Hello? Turn down the radio, please.
It's off.
Thank you.
I enjoy your show so much. I should be in bed, but I wanted to call in. You had asked about music from that region, and I was up all night the other night looking on YouTube. And if you Google YouTube Abkhazia dance or Ossetia or Ossetian dance, you get the ensembles, the music, and the dancing, and much of it is the most amazing mountain people, very masculine war dancing with knives in the teeth, quite magnificent. And the other person who I'm sure could put you on the trail is, Valery Gergiev.
I do not.
He is a great star conductor, magnificent musician. He conducts at the Metropolitan Opera. He's from Ossetia.
Indeed.
Yes, and I think it might even be on YouTube, where they have him walking around where his school was and walking around in the beautiful mountain landscapes of Ossetia, and he's sort of wringing his hands like there should only be peace. There. He was a very great talent as a youngster and went through the school system and got picked up as a future star and was nurtured all along. He's tremendous talent.
I will look into that.
But taken into the Russian sphere because they're, the music school and all.
Mm-hmm. I'll look
if you have access to YouTube.
Well, yes, I know everything in the world is on the internet, but unfortunately for radio airplay, the sound quality frequently is not so good when I play from the computer. It's much better to play from a disc.
Right. Well, it may lead you to the names of people who
right.
have the disc. What I also found charming, because this was before the heavy fighting, was different groups in that region, they try to write to each other in macho style in the commentary. And so they're trying to say, bad words in English, but they don't spell them right. But it's rather charming. You get the idea that, you know, to my Georgian brothers and sisters, B-R-A-T-H-E-R.
Mm-hmm.
But the, and somebody told me that one of the, there's a Georgian dance called Legend, and there's a YouTube, Georgian Dance and Army, and it's interspersing a very high-tech computer graphics of them doing their traditional dances, and then it switches to soldiers weaving the two together, the, you know, men dancing in the mountains, and then you've got this rather phallic tank coming out to do something. And somebody told me this is our tax money that the CIA or our military gave them the computer graphics to make the video, because it's not, this is not your, you know, standard guy with a homemade thing. It's a,
yeah, well, you know, unfortunately, as much as I love all of this deep ethnic music, frequently in this part of the world, not always, but frequently in this part of the world, it's, you know, linked to this resurgent ethno-nationalist, militaristic, ugly kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
Not always, but frequently.
There was a film on Channel 13 this evening about Belarus and a performance artist who's fighting against the dictatorship there, you know, with all kinds of prank and performance artists.
Hmm.
But it gets kind of complicated because he got a Russian woman, all of these regions have lots of Russians who had moved in.
Yeah.
Got her pregnant, had no interest in visiting the child, sort of ruined her life. And then he says to her, well, you're not on our territory. If you had been from Belarus, it would have been different. I would have asked your forgiveness.
Mm.
And she says to him, you know, that's totalitarian nationalism.
Mm. Okay, well,
all right, thank you very
much. Yeah, it's good to go surfing around on YouTube. I know it's a lot of good stuff, but unfortunately, in addition to it frequently not being quite broadcast quality, they don't even really give full information as to who the performers are, so you really get off on it, but there's kind of like a tease because you don't, there's not really enough context given. So that's my, I know there's good stuff. In fact, some people on the Good Light board posted some really, really good links to Uyghur musicians from YouTube, but not only was it really not quite broadcast quality, but they didn't give the names or of the musicians, so I don't know where to find it. But I did find.
Well, if you go through, if you look up the country on Wikipedia, and then there'll be like institutions
museum. I know. I've done all that, believe me. But trying to get the actual disc here in New York is the big challenge. Okay, thank you for your call.
Okay,
we're going to see if we can squeeze in a couple more. WBAI, you're on the air.
Death to NATO and its tools in Georgia. Shakashvili.
WBAI, you're on the air.
Let me turn the radio down.
Please do. Turn the radio down.
Hello?
Hello.
Oh, man. What was that previous phone caller?
Which one?
The one before me.
Well, do you mean the one immediately before you or the woman who was calling
Not
in?
Not the woman. I just heard like a...
Yeah, the Death to Shakashvili character.
Oh,
well. Well, I think we understand where he's coming from.
Yeah. You should go to Cuba, you bunch of commies.
Oh, the other smelly little orthodoxy heard from... Really heartwarming. 212-209-2900 is the number. 212-209-2900. In the 5 minutes which we have remaining to us, if nobody has anything more intelligent to say, we're going to go out with more music from the Rastavi Choir. So it's up to you. WBAI, you're on the air.
You hate Castro just like that tool of the sea.
WBAI, you're on the air.
Here. You hate
Castro. Turn down your radio, sir. Turn down your radio.
Yeah.
Turn down your radio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a Georgian guy. I'm from Georgia.
Okay. Welcome aboard.
Hello. Yeah. I'm really happy that you guys can discuss about the Georgia. Now I'm American, maybe, but it helps me a lot what's going on in Georgia. And I will be, if I can help you with any questions, I will be appreciate.
Well, for first and foremost, what's your perspective about the events which we've witnessed over the past 5 days?
Well, possible to, it's amazing. It's what's going on with these Russian bastards. They do everything to make a fight with Russia and Ossetia. Osetia and North Osetia and South Osetia, this is Georgian territory. So now what they do, they go give some few of the citizens over there, South Osetia citizenship, Russian citizenship, and now they want this territory from Georgia, because this is main crossing from Caucasus Mountain. The Russians want Abkhazia. Abkhazia is the same thing, because they don't have interest to the Black Sea. Ukraine took a Krim, and they don't have any interest to use Black Sea anymore. So now they losing the Caucasus because of that pipeline and because of that main crossing from Europe, Asia to Asia. Is a main crossing, that period of Caucasus Mountain is the valley over there. So this territory held by Osetia. So these people, he wants this territory. That's why him, Russians, is making fight between Osetia and Georgia.
Okay, but it does appear that the Ossetians don't wish to live under Georgian rule.
No, they make him look like this. The Ossetians live with Georgians already few hundred years.
Mm-hmm. So you believe that the conflict was completely fomented by Russia?
Of course. Listen, my friend, we are Americans. We live here. We're not stupid. We see everything. We feel everything. And all the world knows what's going on. Listen, in my country, if I occupy, listen, how come Georgia starts war? Georgia never starts war because he protects his territory. Russia wants with the power give citizenship to the Ossetians. Now he says, I gotta protect my citizens.
Yes, I know.
This is wrong. This is Georgia's territory.
Well, yes, but it seems that the Ossetians were willing to accept Russian citizenship. So I believe we have to ask that. Well, thank you for your call, sir. We're going to see if we can squeeze in one or two more. Maybe there's an Ossetian out there trying to call in who can give us his side of the story. WBAI, you're on the air.
BAI is the platform for the World Anti-Communist League, the captive nation.
WBAI, you're on the air.
Well, you've been devoting a lot of time to Georgia. What about South Carolina? You suck.
WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down the radio, please. Turn down the radio.
Yeah, turn it down.
Thank you.
Go to Cuba where you belong, you commie.
Well, you know, it's really vindicating to be getting it from both sides, I must say. Really, really vindicating it to be getting it from the anti-communist and the Stalinist alike. Really makes me feel like I'm exactly where I belong. So with that, you know, nobody else is calling. And, well, we had at least a couple of interesting calls along with a lot of duds. Let's go out with a little bit more music from the Rostavi Choir, Heroic Songs and Hymns from Georgia, from Shanaki Records. And maybe next week, since I found some Uyghur music, maybe we'll be, and if they continue, if the situation in Xinjiang continues to escalate over the course of the next 7 days, maybe we will return to Uyghurstan next week. So, and continue in this theme of the contemporary great game. This has been, for better or worse, the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. My name is Bill Weinberg. Please do stay tuned for Weaponry with Tom Whisker. Coming up next, see you next week. Ohala and Salam Aleikum. Okay, let's hear some more Georgian music. Okay, you ready, guys?
Oh.
Remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.